The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Women of Washington is a series of weekly radio interviews with Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives, role models for the next generation of Washington leaders. Aileen and Gigi interview the most accomplished women in Washington who share their life lessons and secrets to success.
I'm Aileen Black.
I'm Gigi Shum.
Today, our guest is Susan Gibson. Susan is the Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Susan received her JD from the University of Seattle, and she has two LLMs, one in military and operational law from the Army Judge Advocates General School, and a second in national security law from the University of Virginia. Welcome to the Women of Washington.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Susan, Deputy General Counsel for the Director of National Intelligence. That has to be a very interesting job in these times. Tell us about your role or your mission in the job in the General Counsel's office.
Well, I think our mission is a lot like any other general counsel's office in government in some ways, and then in other ways, it's completely different. And to give you an idea, I mean, every general counsel has, you know, the laws that you have to help everybody with, the personnel, ethics, what you can spend taxpayer money on, those sorts of things, for this very small agency, which is the Director of National Intelligence's office. Then the role that we have that's different than almost anyone else is the director also has a mission across the other 16 intelligence community elements. And we are not the intelligence community's general counsel, but at the same time, we are sort of the go-betweens or the honest brokers or what have you when there are differences of opinion between the general counsels and the various intelligence agencies or when something needs to get explained to the Hill. Or something like that. We are oftentimes the people who are called in to sort of gather that all together, make sure everyone's talking to each other, make sure that folks agree or that we've worked out whatever differences we have. So it's turned out to be a really interesting job. Earlier in my career, I did some international law work where you're trying to negotiate with nation states. And sometimes it feels like that, where these are actually very sovereign nations, these intelligence community elements, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, they're very much entities in their own right. So trying to get them to all sort of play nicely together can be a challenge, but it's a fun challenge.
No, that sounds very interesting these times. Now, one of your degrees is in national security law. I mean, what is that?
Well, it's something that they didn't used to have. It's a fairly new field of law, but more and more popular, and particularly in this city, most of the law schools around here now have national security law degrees. University of Virginia was one of the early ones to do so, probably because the Army JAG School is right next to it. But it's somewhat international law and what people always looked at as international law, treaties, space law, things like that. But this is also sort of how nation states behave, how constitutions are developed, how they're different from various countries. One of the papers I wrote for my second LLM was actually on how do you go about doing free and fair elections in a nation that doesn't really have a social structure. It's a very hard thing when the only social structure, for example, is a religious structure. Not that we're seeing that anywhere around the world. So, you know, how does this happen? How do nations form? How do they change? And how does that affect our national security then? What's happening in all these other nations around the world?
You've got a fascinating job, but let's go way back in time to before you had any of these jobs when you were still in school. You mentioned something about a band teacher ending up to have a pretty pivotal role in your life.
Oh, that is the way back machine, isn't it? As long as I don't have to say what year it was, when I was in high school, none of my family went to college. So I was the first one in my family to go to college. And honestly, I didn't think I would go to college. My mom actually made me take typing because every woman was going to be a secretary. So you needed to know how to type. It's turned out to be very useful since we're all using computers now. But at the time, that's why I took it. And when I was a junior in high school, I actually got a letter. And I credit the Congress telling West Point they were going to let women in. That's what got me to college, because I got a letter from West Point asking me if I wanted to apply. And I was sitting in the band room. I played saxophone in the band. sitting in the band room, we were having lunch because that's where all the band kids had lunch. You drag your lunch in and sit in there. And we were laughing. I was laughing like, why would I want to do this? You know, go all the way to New York and go to this military academy. And isn't this a hoot? And why'd they send me this letter? And we were all laughing about it. And my band director, Pete Basola, what a great guy. He actually stopped me. He says, you need to stop laughing. And why wouldn't you go to college? And why wouldn't you do this? And it was sort of one of those times when you go, oh, I guess I could, especially when he said, and oh, by the way, it's free, which was a big deal. There wasn't a lot of money floating around in my home. My folks were divorced. My mom was the manager of the school cafeteria in one of the elementary schools in my hometown. So that was my, you know, my home life. So this idea of going to college and who would pay for it and all of that, it just wasn't going to happen until I got that letter asking me to apply to West Point. I didn't end up going to West Point, but that conversation and my band director actually pulling me aside and saying, no, seriously, you need to consider this. It changed my life. And it's funny how something that sort of casual can change the entire course of your life.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what would have happened if you hadn't been having your lunch in that room during that day. How about other formative influences in your life during those years?
Well, my mother, obviously, because I was living with my mother. And to her credit, you know, when I came home and said, hey, Mom, you know, let's think about this seriously. She was very, very supportive and didn't really know how to help and immediately did what she's always done is found ways to help. She's reached out to people. She's one of these people who is very good about reaching out to other people to find out, how do I make this happen? You know, who do I need to talk to? And so she sort of started on this self-education campaign of what does it take and what do you have to do? And drug me all over then looking at colleges, you know, when I was a senior, once we decided, okay, maybe this is possible. And I started getting scholarship offers and things like that. And she just drove me everywhere. And we sort of figured it out together, how you apply for college. It's an art form. And if you've not had anyone in your family go to college, figuring it all out is not easy. And so she took the time to do that. And that's just one example. I mean, she has been that supportive, everything I've ever wanted to do in my career and my life.
That's wonderful. There's so many scholarships and grants money out there that people actually don't use. And if somebody had that kind of guidance out there, there's a lot more people that can go to college. You're very fortunate.
Yes, I think everybody needs to consider it. And people who think it isn't possible, there's almost always a way to make it happen.
Today, our guest is Susan Gibson, Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Susan, you didn't go to West Point.
No.
But you ended up in the military. So what made you choose to serve our country?
Oh, this is a long story. So I didn't go to West Point, but I did look into it. And one of the ways I looked into it was going to my high school counselor. And she said, well, there's one of the high school students who's actually there now. And his name was Tim Gibson. And I got a hold of him the summer between my junior and senior year. He'd just finished his first year at West Point to ask him, what's the academy like? There were no women there yet, and no one really knew what they were going to do with the women there or how that would work. So I talked to him that summer, and we started dating and ended up getting married. We've been married 35 years now, so I met my husband in high school. Strangely enough, I knew him before he went to West Point. He was in the Army, and there I was after we got married. I was at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and in the early 80s, there was nothing around Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I was bored, bored, bored. Here I am. I finished college early. I've got a double major and I can't get a job. I'm making costumes at the theater on post and basically reading everything in the library. I ride my bike. We have one car. I ride my bike to the library every other day. And the librarians ask me if I'm checking out books for other people because I'm just bored. And finally, one day I decided that he was either going to get out of the Army or I was going to get in. And I did all this research when there was no internet to do the research on. So I'm calling around to all these phone numbers, trying to find out how you get into the Army without being ROTC or going to officer candidate school. And finally, after many, many calls, because the recruiters just wanted me to enlist and weren't going to refer me to anyone else, after many calls, I found out that you could be a chaplain. You could be a doctor or a dentist, or you could be a lawyer. And the one that was appealing to me, and I'd actually thought about before, was going to law school. So when my husband came home from work that day, I just hit him with it at the door. Honey, you're going to get stationed somewhere where I can go to law school, and I'm going to go to law school. And then at that point, we'll decide whether you're getting out or I'm getting in. And when I think back on it, I'm surprised he didn't just turn around and walk back out the door. But he supported me through that and finished law school and looked into it and decided that what we really wanted to do was both serve. We didn't know how long we'd be able to pull it off, but we figured for however long it worked, it would be a great adventure and a good thing to do. And so off we went.
We're speaking with Susan Gibson, Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Coming up, we'll ask Susan what it was like having both she and her husband serve in the Army. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Susan Gibson. Susan is the Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Susan, you and your husband were both in the military, in the Army, in fact. What was it like balancing two successful military careers?
It was a balance. I think anybody who tells you otherwise is lying to you. You end up trading off a lot. And we actually did this very consciously during our careers, where one of us needed to go to a school or have a particular job at that point in our career. And we sit down and we go, okay, it's your turn. We're going to go where you need to go and I'll find something and just follow along. And then the next time it would switch, you know, oh, I need to go somewhere. Okay, now it's your turn and I'll just follow along. It was funny because people told us at the beginning that there's really no chance that we'd both make it to the end successfully. At some point, one of us would have to get out. And I remember when I got pregnant the first time, everybody said, oh, so now you're going to get out. And I was like, no, I think we're going to keep trying it until it just, you know, doesn't work anymore. And then when I got pregnant the second time, they're like, oh, well, now surely you're going to have to quit. And we kept saying, heck, let's just keep doing it 1 year at a time. And if it falls apart at some point, then we'll decide what we're going to do. But it never fell apart. We always put the priority on keeping the family together as if we could at all. So that means you end up in places that other people may not want to get assigned, like Kansas or places like that, that don't seem that appealing to other people. Surprisingly, Hawaii was like that too when we got stationed there. People with children of a certain age didn't want to go over because the schools were difficult. So we would actually call up our assignments officers and say, okay, where does no one else want to go? We spent 2 years in Korea for that reason as well with our family. But at the same time, we had a ball. We went great places. We understood each other's jobs. So you mentored each other, too. In the early days, he was infantry. By the end, he was doing computer network stuff. So you got a lawyer, you got an infantryman. That's kind of, you know, both sides of what's going on in the Army, a lot of it. So we could answer each other's questions. We understood what was going on in both our professional lives and our personal lives. And he was a wonderful, wonderful partner. Otherwise, there's no way that I could have had the career that I had. And I think a lot of women, successful women, will tell you that you have to pick a person who's going to support you. And he did every step of the way. So we just sort of faked it.
Back when you joined the military, it was quite different. And one of the things that has happened pretty recently is the Secretary of Defense announced that women will now have access to all roles in mm-hmm. the military, including those combat positions that were previously not open to women. So I know that as a lawyer, you probably weren't ever faced with the possibility of going into a combat position. But just from your perspective as somebody who did serve for so long, What do you think about that change and how it will impact the military today?
So I think about that change the way I think about any other change where a profession or opportunity is opened up to women. And that is, if you only make opportunities available to half of the population, you're cutting out an awful lot of talent. And for those women who don't have those opportunities, if you expect them to excel, and you're not going to give them some of the most challenging opportunities, how do you expect them to develop? Letting women into West Point is a classic example. If that's supposed to be the best place to train your officers, the military academies, why would you decide that the women officers didn't need that training? So each one of these works both, I think, for society, because you've opened up the pool of people who are competing, and you're likely to get some very, very good candidates from that new pool that you've opened up. And you're giving women opportunities to prove that they can do new things, and you're giving them opportunities to advance, particularly in the military, because if you shut out those combat roles to women, I don't know why we're surprised that then you kind of have a glass ceiling where they can't get promoted, because that experience is very important for getting promoted in the military. So if you're going to have women there and you want them to advance, you have to give them the opportunity to fill those roles.
You know, women are paid much less than men, just about every industry. And now the government's not so bad, but reports state that overall it's 78 cents to every dollar a man makes. Why do you believe that there is such a huge gap out there?
Well, some of it's obviously historical. I think some of it, though, people are starting to focus on more, and it is changing some. The fact that it's not so bad in the government, I think that's one of the reasons why there are so many women and senior women in government, too, because it's a little more of a level playing field, not just on pay, but in general. The other thing I think is, and I've seen this because I'm a hiring authority for my office and do a lot of this and also advise the human resources staff, women don't tend to negotiate even their first salary and don't negotiate as much even on later salaries when they get new jobs. And I have seen this anecdotally, and there's been a lot written about it lately. But if you start lower, it's harder to ever catch up, because salaries kind of grow that way. And when you get a new job, if you won't negotiate for better pay when you enter into that new job, well, then you're going to be asking for a pay raise that'll get you to the level of the guy who negotiated when he came in the door. So, you know, part of it is we just have to change our culture to some extent and ask for it. I've never seen a job offer withdrawn because somebody negotiated for higher pay. They might tell you no, but they're hardly ever going to withdraw the offer unless you're a jerk about how you're negotiating and doing something you shouldn't be doing. So really, what do you have to lose? And when you think about it that way, it sort of makes it easier to at least ask. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Every day you open the paper, you read about some new cyber attack, some security breach, some inside the government, some outside the government. The Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act bill is up on the Hill and going to be voted on. In the light of recent world events, I'm sure that you end up in the middle of these discussions all the time around how to weigh citizens' right to privacy with the government's responsibility to try to do everything they can to protect the digital assets that the country has.
So that's really two different areas. The privacy area, which I actually spend a lot of time on in my job. One of my main portfolios is protection of information concerning United States persons. So information about you and me that the intelligence community gets a hold of. And so that the privacy piece is one thing, and we could talk about that in a minute. The cybersecurity piece is different. And I think cybersecurity isn't necessarily, you know, an intelligence community job, although we help tell people what the threats are and things like that. It's everybody's job. I mean, it would be like saying everybody drives a car, but nobody's responsible for the safety of how they drive. Well, if you're on computers, if you're using the internet, everybody is responsible for that. And a lot of the cybersecurity problems that we have, while some of it's very sophisticated hacking, the vast, vast majority of it is social engineering, where someone guesses your password because you picked a really bad one, or because you used the same one on several websites, or because they did a phishing campaign with email and they got you to give them some personal information, or your security questions are answers that anybody could find out about you. You know, so pick something obscure like the name of your fish and not your maiden name, those sorts of things. So people can be much more aware. And I think with any new technology, people like to say, oh, that's really hard. And I don't really know that much about it. But a lot of the things you need to do to improve cybersecurity for yourself, for your company, isn't that hard to understand if you just sort of pay attention to it. So I think there's that really basic sort of simple cybersecurity stuff. Writ large, cybersecurity and sort of the risks that are out there, the nation state risks, the hackers and those sorts of things, I think this country's going to have to face it better. I think the dysfunction in government that's stopping a lot of this legislation from passing, the one that you were mentioning did finally pass, but it's a very small step. We've also got to get over this fear of somebody protecting the networks. You need more transparency in, you know, if a company gets hacked, they don't like to tell people they've been hacked. It's bad for business for people to know that you've been hacked. But the people whose information is out there need to know that their information is out there. And somebody else needs to know that this vulnerability is there so that they can patch it or fix it, whether it's other companies, whether it's the government. We have to start thinking and having adult conversations about what the mechanisms are for us to be able to share that information so that we can help each other protect each other. If you want me to go into the privacy aspect, I can do that as well. Part of this is, I think, a lot of the conversation about privacy, particularly post-Snowden, was a lot of people saying, well, if you have these capabilities, you could be doing all these horrible things. Without asking, what does the law allow and what are you actually doing? And there's a huge amount of oversight, both inside the agencies, with Congress, with the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, and other people who make sure that we're following the laws. If you read all the Snowden articles, there are no allegations in there that the NSA was breaking the law. So that's just not a problem that I think we have. And I think we need to sort of ratchet down the rhetoric a little bit and have more sane conversations.
So you mentioned you're ahead of a certain amount of human resources there at ODNI. Are we facing a national security issue associated with the human resources, the people who can help, you know, actually help us solve these cybersecurity issues? And in regards to half the population, women in STEM is actually going down in the hardcore sciences. So what do you think about that as an issue, and how can we address this?
Well, I've already talked about what I think about it as an issue, which is, you know, we're really shutting out half the population. To tell, I care about this one personally. My oldest daughter just finished her PhD in computer science. It was not an easy path for a woman. And even in this day and age, there are not that many women doing it. And her path started when she was in sixth grade in math, when her math teacher told her to stop raising her hand because she was embarrassing the boys. So, you know, when you're fighting against that sort of thing that starts in sixth grade, and then you wonder why girls don't go into these fields, math, science, technology, difficult fields. I mean, we've got to change that in very fundamental ways. And she's only 29. This isn't like it happened in the dark ages. So when she was in sixth grade, this was happening. And I think there's a lot of that, oh, girls aren't supposed to like math. I'm seeing a lot of that change, and I'm hopeful because of that. But I think it's something we all need to be aware of. One of the things that I do in my, quote, spare time is I am also the general counsel. I volunteer with Women in Technology. And one of their goals is to advance women in technology, as they put it, from the classroom to the boardroom. It starts out with a Girls in Technology program where they actually take these girls fairly young in elementary and middle school and start them to get excited about this. Look at all the fun things you can do with this. You have to show them what you can do with it, because I think for a lot of these girls, they're not interested in the technology itself. They're interested in what you can do with it. So you have to show them those possibilities and continue to support that on through. And then these support networks then for women in the profession, that they tend to support each other. And I think women are doing that more, and that's a great thing. And then to the boardroom, that's the other place where women are horribly underrepresented. And quite frankly, in the DC area, more so than in the rest of the nation. So like WIT, Women in Technology, has a leadership foundry where they actually train women on what it takes to be on a corporate board and what they need to do to make themselves more marketable for those positions and to get those positions. Because I think the diversity on those boards changes a lot of these conversations about equal pay, about who you're hiring, about women in technology. And I think we need to look at this representation from the beginning, the classroom, the young classrooms, all the way to the boardroom, just like they're doing. And so I truly believe in that. And I think it's going to take that broad-based mission to change it.
Today, our guest is Susan Gibson, Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of Director of National Intelligence. Coming up, we'll ask Susan about networking and mentorship. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Susan Gibson. Susan is the Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Susan, tell us why mentoring has been important in your life.
I don't think any of us succeed on our own. So I think finding good mentors and taking advantage of them and helping you through particularly tough spots, I didn't always think of it as mentoring. Sometimes it was just someone to think out loud with, or to ask questions, to share experiences with. Lots of times mentoring is just knowing that somebody else has been through what you're going through. And so I think that support helps us all get through the day and through the week and through the next year. It gives us the courage to apply for that really difficult job, things like that. Other people around you telling you that you can do things, because I think sometimes we're terribly critical on ourselves. And so we hold ourselves back in ways that our mentors sort of shove us forward. So if you can find those people, they can change the course of your life in a lot of ways.
Can you think of a particular time when you had somebody who helped you through a rough time, or who recommended that you apply for that job that you weren't sure that you really were ready for?
You know, I can't think of any one particular one. I think it's more of a cumulative effect over time of just those little boosts up over and over and over that keep you from being stuck someplace. The advice you get. I do have one, the first woman in the Army who I thought, oh, I could be like that. Someone who was senior to me, and she became a mentor to me. In the Army, it's not so much applying for the next job because you just get orders, but it's the advice on how to treat certain situations or what to look for, or how to deal with people who could be difficult. And it is different what people will put up with from a woman when you have a difficult situation, and ways that are effective in confronting that versus ineffective. And so having that kind of advice and having someone, for me in particular, and this was 5 years into my career before I ran across a more senior woman who I could even talk to much, because there wasn't anyone in my first assignment, other women in the JAG office anyway. So she had a really profound effect on my career, just because I knew that it was possible to be the kind of person I wanted to be, because I could see myself as her in the future. So sometimes mentoring is just being a role model in sort of a way that people could look and say, oh, I could do that. And so I think that's probably the most profound one.
And then you had an opportunity a little bit later on in your career to be that role model when you went to teach at West Point, right? Tell us about that.
So I was one of the few women professors at West Point, and this is 10 years after they asked me to apply. No, more than that, 14 or 18 years after they asked me to apply, there still were not that many women professors at West Point. And they had years and years of women cadets. And so the women cadets who were there, I would find them sort of lurking around my office door, often on a pretense of, oh, I need to ask you about this, that, or the other. And eventually the conversation, particularly for the seniors who were in there, the conversation would roll around to, how do you do it? How do you pull off a military career and have kids? And, you know, is it really possible? And are you happy? And are you going to, do you think you can make a whole career, or are you going to have to get out at some point? And particularly since my husband was on active duty too, because they sort of saw that if they wanted to have that sort of family life, they were probably going to end up in a dual military career situation. So they were often in my office. And again, I'm not so sure that I was giving them great advice, but just the fact that I existed was somehow mentoring them. It was the role model. And you would give them advice and you'd tell them, you know, it's not terribly easy, but it's not impossible. And if you pick the right person, again, you know, we've talked about that before. You have to pick a husband who's supportive if you're going to get through this. I suppose you could get through without that, but I can't begin to imagine it. You know, we would talk about those sorts of things. So that was, it was great. I had a lot of women cadets in my office and they dragged their roommates in. And it was actually quite a very rewarding experience.
So did you find the person who sent you that letter from West Point? Because that letter from West Point did so many things for you. You met your spouse. You ended up going to college.
You know, I don't even think I still have the letter. You know, it's one of those things that you wish. I know you wish you keep those things, don't you? Looking back on it, yeah, I hadn't thought of it, but it's like the turning point in my life.
You brought up WIT or women in technology a little bit earlier, but sometimes there isn't mentors or women mentors in an organization. So networking resources and other types of organizations are not always clear to women. Do you have any recommendations on how somebody can find a mentor outside of their career?
I think going looking for a mentor is probably the worst way to find a mentor. I think mentors tend to happen a little less formally than that. And I've had people come up to me and say, would you be my mentor? But the really good mentoring relationships don't start out that way. I think you look for somebody you admire and you watch them for a while. If you get a chance to work for them, you jump at the chance to work for them. I'm a firm believer. When I was in college, I used to pick classes because I liked a particular professor or because they were interesting, not necessarily because I was, you know, that interested in that subject, but you just knew you were going to learn a lot from that person. And I think in life, you find people like that too, where if you work for this person or you work in an organization with people like that, the mentoring relationship happens on its own. And if you can't find somebody like that in your job, then get involved in any organization. It doesn't have to be an organization like WIT. That's an obvious one and, you know, great if you want to do that. But get involved in something else that you care about and find someone in that organization who you admire and who you can learn things from. Typically, you're not learning things about your own profession from your mentor. You're learning things about how to be a professional, how to be more executive when you get to that point in your career where you think, oh, how would you handle this? Or how do I, you know, I've got this big project. How do I make sure that I manage it correctly? So it's that sort of advice you get. It doesn't have to be someone who's in your field. Many of my mentors aren't lawyers. For a woman in technology, you don't have to have someone who's in technology to be a really good mentor.
For some of our listeners out there that might be interested in joining OD&I, does OD&I have any mentor programs or internships?
They do have some mentor programs for people who are in OD&I already. We don't have that many internships, mainly because OD&I is sort of a headquarters level element. So there aren't many internships. We do have a few, but I would encourage people who want to be in OD&I. I wouldn't look at it like that. The OD&I is only part of a much larger community in the intelligence community, and most of those intelligence community elements have internships, very robust internships, fascinating internships, CIA, NSA, DIA, NGA, all of those acronym places have internships, and most of them are posted on their websites, which is whatever their acronym is, .gov typically, and they post those internships up there, and they're great opportunities. And I think people in government tend to be natural mentors because I think the competition is a little bit different. We don't feel quite as competitive. It's more of a team sport. And the intelligence community is particularly like that. We keep getting every year the best places to work in government awards and things like that. And I think that's a lot of it. You've got a really good mission and really good people. And that makes for a really fun job.
Today, our guest is Susan Gibson, the Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Coming up, we'll find out what Susan likes to do when she's not working. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio. com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Susan Gibson. Susan is the Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. You've had such a successful career. We talked a little bit about balancing two military careers, but with all your competing priorities in your life, many women have to talk about having to make hard choices. Did you make hard choices along the way to be able to achieve this success, both in your personal and your professional life?
Oh, I think any woman who's gotten anywhere has had to make those choices. And I think you make them both large and small all the time. You can't have it all. You can have some of it today and some of it tomorrow, but you can't have all of it all the time. There aren't enough hours in the day to do it, and you don't have enough energy to pull it off. So I think you always make those choices. And, you know, it's good to have choices. And we often choose, particularly when you've got to decide which career path to take, because we've all hit those points in our career. I did criminal law for a long, long time. And changing to national security law was one of those things where you're like, will I be able to go back if I don't like it? And sometimes you just have to jump in with both feet and go for it and make those choices. And in life balance, I talked already about, you know, my husband and I kind of having to trade off who got to pick where we went next, who needed that assignment the most. And we made those decisions. And with the girls, you know, you couldn't always go. So we would actually negotiate with our children. So if I only can go to one of these, which one do you really want me there for? They understand. They understand about that far more than you'd think they would, because they live their lives like that too. You can't sign up for every class or every outside activity. They have to make choices. They understand that you have to make choices too.
When we were doing research for this interview, we found that you are actively involved as an ambassador for the Shakespeare Theater Company, and also you're on the board of directors at Fairfax Theater. So tell us about that other life of Susan.
Oh, we go to far more theater than any human being should go to, probably, but we love it. My husband and I both love theater, and Washington, D.C. has become an amazing theater town. When we got here right before 9/11, and we'd always gone to theaters in places where we'd been stationed, but usually there was only one. When we got here, there were several good theaters, and it's only gotten better in that time. Shakespeare Theater, we got involved with early on and have become ambassadors, which is kind of just a fancy volunteer. But it's been great fun, and you get to know the actors who are there regularly and watch them grow and develop. You get to know the directors once you start recognizing those names, and it just enriches the experience to a great extent. Very involved with Signature Theater, City of Fairfax Theater, that kind of was an outgrowth. When you're hanging around with that many theater people, eventually someone will ask you to come help with something like that. So I was asked to be on the board. It's a very young community theater, so it's sort of exciting to figure out how to get it rolling, how to get it off the ground in the city of Fairfax, which is a lovely old town kind of in the middle of the sprawl around D.C. So we don't have our own theater there, and we're one of the few communities that didn't have a community theater. So growing that and growing it for the community, both as a resource for people who want to do theater, and also as a resource for the community that draws in people and that is something fun to do in the city. So I really, really love it. And if you haven't seen theater in D.C., please do. We go to Broadway. We go over to London a lot to see theater, and you will see theater every bit as good right here in D.C. So that's been one of our passions. We spend a lot of time at the theater.
Do you have any background in the theater yourself in terms of either on stage or behind the scenes?
Oh, when I was young, you know, everybody does a little bit of it, I think, but in high school. And I made costumes for the theater before I went to law school at a theater in Kentucky.
Right, I remember you telling
yeah,
that story.
Which is really kind of bizarre when you think about it, like what was I doing? But it was great fun. So you have that, and you kind of understand a little bit about what it takes if you've been in a couple of shows to put a show on. So it gives you an appreciation for how hard it is to make it look easy. So that's been, so that background. But I'm not a performer anymore in that sense, other than just kind of how lawyers are maybe performers when you're in the courtroom, which is somewhat alike. So there is that.
Do you have a favorite play?
No, I have too many that I like. And I sort of switch between, there's some Shakespeare I really love, but I'm actually kind of a musical nut. So I love musicals and all of them, I think. So.
Susan, as our interview is coming to a close, I personally want to thank you for all the information that you provided in sharing your path with us. But I got to ask you, if you were to go back in time and to see the younger Susan before you went off to school, what piece of advice would you want her to have this kind of success that you've been able to achieve?
You'd like to think you'd go back and tell yourself how to do this, but I'm not sure I'd want to. My life has been not at all the path that I would have expected or maybe even chosen consciously, but it's been so wonderful that I'd almost be afraid to go back and give myself advice because I might mess it up, you know, that space-time continuum thing. But I think if I had to give myself some advice, there are some things you'd always want to say, like, you know, don't be afraid of this. And I think, you know, don't be afraid of the knot in your stomach. You kind of have to embrace it. And I've learned that every time I took that job that gave me the knot in the stomach, that was the one that really sort of pushed, you know, my skills forward and my career forward. So, you know, embrace that. And maybe, you know, if I go back, you'd say, and if you're taking a new job and it doesn't give you a knot in the stomach, maybe you haven't, you know, you haven't reached far enough. So that's a little piece of advice. The other piece of advice I think I'd give myself, particularly in the early part of my career, is always have a vacation planned. When you're going through the really rough spots, and I always do now, my husband's wonderful about this. He's like the best vacation planner in the world. And we always have the next one out there on the horizon so that when you're having a really bad day, you're like, that's okay. Cause 2 months from now, I'm going wherever you're going and going to have a great vacation and take a break, recharge your batteries and come back in and face whatever you have to face.
Today, our guest is Susan Gibson, Principal Deputy General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Aileen and I are founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. You can learn more about AGS and the work we can do to help accelerate your business plans for public sector at excelgovstrat.com. I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.